history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories there that really ought to be heard. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price has been paid for our freedom. And you know, when we start out on that path, by the time we're done, we've learned a lot, we've been educated, entertained, and so often we've been inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. It's been inspiring, even in the midst of this global coronavirus pandemic, to hear stories of some of the World War II veterans overcoming this awful disease, like a 104-year-old vet in Oregon this week. I did say 104. That greatest generation may also be the most resilient generation. And 75 years ago this week, so many of our most able-bodied Americans found themselves on or around the island of Okinawa for the last major battle of the war in the Pacific. That battle lasted 82 days, saw more than 12,000 Americans killed and more than 50,000 wounded. Today, we're going to hear from three men who survived that battle, one on land, one in the air, and one at sea, during a time in which kamikaze attacks were more frequent than any other period in the history of the world. Three young men from three different states, New Jersey, South Dakota, and California, to give the rest of us a taste of what this massive battle, at the time one last island hop before the planned invasion of mainland Japan, was really like. We start with a 19-year-old from California who came ashore on Easter Sunday, 1945, with the 1st Tank Battalion, David Fusinato.
The 1st Marine Division landed on Okinawa April 1st, April Fool's Day of 1945. The area we were supposed to occupy included Kadena Airfield and Yantan Airfield, and they're just adjacent to one another. No resistance. We went across the island, halfway across the island the first day, occupied our area of both airfields. I was set up for the bivouac and overnight. What we were going to do the next day, we were just going to advance a little further across the island, across the narrowest part of the island, actually. And that night, we suffered some bombardment from, they had big guns in the hills, just, maybe 12, 15 miles away from the airports, and they shelled the airfields, runways, tore them up pretty bad the first night. But that was the first time we were under fire after we landed on the island. First night was kind of rough, and that's the first time any of us had experienced a lot of bombardment. I guess everybody was scared. I know I was. If you don't say you're scared, well, you're lying.
Did it kind of suck you guys in that you were able to advance so quickly when you landed that there was no opposition to the actual landing?
We couldn't figure it out. We figured we were being in a trap, and they were just waiting for us to get on the island, and they were going to cut loose on us, bonsai and all, whatever you hear, you know, through the scuttlebutt. But nothing happened, and so we were on the island about 25 days before we even got into combat. And during those 25 days, we used to bring in supplies with Amtraks and trucks. And then we started combat training. They had to keep us busy doing something because we were just standing around there. They put us in combat training all over again. We cleaned all the guns over and over every day, cleaned the guns just to keep us busy, keep our mind off of what was coming, which we didn't know what was coming.
But you did know that they were shelling you at nighttime?
Oh, no. They stopped the shelling. Then the kamikaze came in. We could watch the anti-aircraft display every night. And the kamikaze would come in. And during the day, too. And from the island, we could see the whole harbor and ships being hit by suicide airplanes and carriers. And it was devastating.
And I imagine kind of a helpless feeling, too, that you guys are there. There's plenty of you, but you're just sitting around. Hurry up and wait, I guess, huh?
Exactly, yeah. So around the, it was about the, 26th of April, the 1st Marine Division was called up to the front lines to relieve an Army division. Took all our equipment and camp and everything and moved up near the front lines, which was the Shuri line on Okinawa. And the next day, we were in the front lines operating our tanks with the artillery and the infantry.
So what were your duties with the tank?
Well, I started out as a loader in the tank. That's loading the 75-millimeter gun. The loader's also the radio man. I probably spent the time loading maybe a couple of weeks or so, and one of the gunners in another tank in my company got wounded, and so I took his place as gunner. So I had a little experience in shooting the gun in combat, the big gun.
When you finally were on the front lines, that first day of actually seeing what was going on and experiencing it firsthand and not just standing, what was that like for you? What was the biggest impression that it made on you?
Well, you were so busy inside the tanks that you hardly had time to think about what was going on the outside. But we did see a lot of Marines that were wounded. We could see them through the periscope in the tanks. Of course, they would operate with us, and we'd kind of operate with them. And sometimes it was protection for them because they'd, stay close to the tank so they could they wouldn't be hit by small arms fire or anything. And they would direct our targets a lot of times, too. They had an intercom. They had a phone on the outside of the tank where the infantry could keep in contact with the tank commander.
How secure did you feel inside this tank? Did you feel more secure knowing that you had that armor around you, or less secure knowing that as a tank you're a bigger target?
Yeah, I felt pretty secure till we took a hit on top of the turret. And it jarred everybody in the tank, but fortunately nobody was really seriously wounded or got a lot of bruises and stuff, but outside of that, everybody was okay. We think it was a mortar hit the top of the tank.
What did it feel like?
It jarred everybody inside the tank.
Did you leave your feet?
No, because if I left my feet, I would bump my head on the inside top of the turret.
But it gave you a little shaking.
Oh, yes, shook everybody up. That's the only time we got hit by anything big. We took a lot of small arms fire. Any tank weapons didn't hit our tank in particular, but the tanks around us got hit by anti-tank weapons. And the Japanese had a good one, too, a 47-millimeter.
What did you see happen to those tanks that got hit by that?
Well, most of them survived. I took a hit in the side and penetrated the tank, but it didn't do any damage on the inside of the tank. I believe one of them had the tracks knocked off of it by an explosive, but the crew got out and got back to the off the front line, so they were okay. One of our tanks, it wasn't the platoon I was in, they got hit one time, and I believe the gunner was killed and the driver was seriously wounded. That was out of our company. Now, the other companies, I really don't know. I really can't say anything about them.
So you knew, though, what could possibly happen to you guys. That was always out there.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
Initially, when you were the loader and handling the radio, how much visual contact did you have outside the tank? Did you have any idea where you were going, or are you pretty much blind?
Because every hatch had a periscope. You could see exactly where you were going, and you can turn the periscope around with 360 degrees, so you can see pretty much where you are in the area and any enemy coming towards you. As a gunner, you have a telescopic sight.
That was my question. Once you became a gunner, did that kind of give you a different view of the whole war?
A very, very different view. Yeah, you had your telescopic sight, plus you had your, which you could see all over. I mean, close up. But that was a lot different than being a loader, I tell you. Once I pick out a target with the telescopic sight, I can tell the tank commander through the intercom radio, I have a target in sight, and then he'll look at it with it, maybe his binoculars or through the periscope or something, and then say, fire away.
And what kind of targets are you firing upon?
Caves mostly, and if we can find an open cave, then we open fire on it. And sometimes you can't see anything at all along the ridges, and a lot of times the infantry alongside of us picks out a target. They phone the tank commander and tank commander gives a message to the gunner exactly, just about exactly where's that. Oh, I forgot to tell you, alongside the big gun, there's a 30 caliber that's coaxed to the big gun. And you fire the 30 caliber, and it's got tracers, every third bullet, fourth bullet. And so you can pick out the target exactly. And the tank commander says, yeah, you're right on it, so fire away. So then you fire the small gun first, pick out your target, and then fire the big gun.
How long did that go? Did you go in spurts of 10, 15 minutes at a time? Did you feel like it was the whole day through going nonstop? What was that like for you as far as how intense and how engaged you were?
When you go in the front lines, it's all day, from daylight till dark. We couldn't keep our tanks on the front lines after dark. We'd have to pull back to the tank area, refueling, re-ammo, clean the guns, get ready for the next day action. So every night we'd pull off the lines, leave the infantry out there all by themselves. I really felt sorry for them, but nothing we could do, and that's the way we operated.
How exhausting was that to be on and have the pressure on and be really fighting for your life from daybreak till sunset?
Well, I don't know. I guess you kind of get immune to it, you know, kind of numb. We set up machine gun nests all around the perimeter of the tank park and stand guard most of the night. Well, 4 or 5 hours anyway. And luckily, you get 3 or 4 hours sleep before you had to get up and go back into the front lines again.
Is it fair to say that could be more agonizing than what you're doing during the day? Because you can't see anything? You don't know when something's
exactly.
going to happen?
Yeah, it's just pretty scary at night there, especially when they send the flares up and the flares come down and you see all these shadows out there in the distance. And you don't know if the enemy is moving out there towards you or if it's just shadows from the flare coming down and you know, moving tree branches and trees, and so it's pretty scary at night.
Was there anything that kind of kept you going, kept you focused, kept you determined to make it through another day? Because this, I mean, it seems like when you do this day after day, it could really drain you and kind of wear on you.
I don't know. I guess we did the best we could. No, we had to do it, and we had a job to do, and somehow we got through a day today. We just had to keep going, that's all.
I imagine there had to be some times there where it felt like it was never going to end.
Exactly. A very serious situation, a very devastating combat is something you can't explain. It's just unbelievable.
I know when you're in the middle of it, it's very difficult to see the big picture and have a grasp of what's happening around you. But did it get to a point where you started to see signs of victory on its way, of the battle nearing its end?
With the Battle of Okinawa, once we took the Shuri line, the Japanese moved as far south as they could. They were near the southern tip of the island. And so we knew that, you know, it was just a matter of time where we'd win the battle, secure the island.
In all those days of combat and staring through that periscope and firing away and seeing everything that was happening around you, are there any things that you saw or witnessed that really stand out that left the biggest impression on you?
Yeah, one day was pretty scary. We had three tanks in a column, and we were headed to the front lines, and we were warned about suicide Japanese soldiers. They would carry what we call satchel charges, and they would hide alongside of the road in their spider holes or whatever. And as a tank came along, they would run out and throw the satchel charge in the tracks of the tank. Well, the satchel charge would explode, blow the tracks off the tank. And one day we were going up to the front lines, and I saw one of those little buggers come off the side of the road there, and he had a satchel charge in his hand, and he threw it at the tank. Luckily, it bounced off the tank, the side of the tank, and in the meantime, our middle tank shot him. And so that was a pretty scary moment. We were waiting for the big explosion.
And he threw it at your tank or a tank in front of you?
No, it was the middle tank. The middle tank took the hit. But luckily, it bounced off the tank, so that was probably the worst that I actually saw.
Did the sheer volume of casualties
ever get to you? Was that ever something that became an intimidating or imposing thought in your mind to see how many of your fellow Marines were dying there?
We knew we suffered heavy casualties, but we never knew the figures until later on, actually till after the war, after VJ Day. And then we realized, you know, how devastating that battle was.
That's David Fusinato, who survived the Battle of Okinawa with the 1st Tank Battalion 75 years ago. Before we're done, we're going to hear from one of the countless American sailors wounded by kamikaze attacks off of Okinawa. But up next, a fighter pilot who had his own close calls there. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.